Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Jim Burns, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Right now, you're in the Bullyproof Classroom, and it's been a long time since I've done anything in terms of broadcasting a little bit using the medium of internet radio and Blog Talk Radio in particular. I really have developed a lot of great information over the course of my last show, which may have been, I don't know, may have been over a year or maybe two ago. And right now we are in the process of developing a whole lot of stuff, and some of it's already been developed. As you know, I'm the author of the Bullyproof Classroom, the graduate course, and more recently that course just went up online, and it can be taken by anyone by going to www.therTC.net, which is the company that launches the course for me, and credit is awarded through two different colleges, one in Pennsylvania, that's Gratz College, and the other one is, of course, right here in New Jersey, which is the College of New Jersey. Teachers who are in the field can take this course, and they can receive 3 graduate credits. And in New Jersey, you have to have a certain amount of anti-bullying training because of the law that was passed in 2010 and went into effect in 2011. Which was the Anti-Bullying Bill of Rights, which was as a result of a young man, Tyler Clemente, who took his own life because of cyberbullying that he experienced while he was at Rutgers University. The website that you can go to gather information on any of this stuff is www.bullyproofclassroom.com. And if you look up to the right on the site, what you're going to find is a section where you can take a 5-hour training course in anti-bullying. That's going to be launched sometime in the summer. We're still putting together 5 hours, and those 5 hours will be taken from the Bullyproof Classroom, the graduate course. And there will be 5 5-hour modules that you'll be able to take. Our first module will be on how to strengthen the victim of bullying to give him some more resiliency or her more resiliency as she deals with bullying either in the home, in the community, or in school. We also have on the site the Anti-Bullying Coffee House Forum, which is a way for you to weigh in and have conversation on the topic of bullying. And we'd love to hear some strategies, things that you're doing. We'd also like to hear, if you're a teacher or if you're a parent, doesn't matter. We also like to hear any experiences you may have had as a child or as an adult, because adult bullying takes place an awful lot in society today. Parents can get bullied by their kids. Parents can get bullied by their adults, can get bullied by their boss. It is a pervasive problem that is out there, and it needs a lot of attention. It really does. There's a tremendous amount of dysfunction that has occurred as a result of bullying in our culture and in society. Tonight, I'd love to hear from you. And if you'd like to call in and chat, weigh in with any information that you may have on bullying, about teaching, about things that you're experiencing, please call in. We're at 646-595-4965. Again, that number, 646-595-4965. And feel free to give us a call. We're going to be on the air for an hour, so we're going to be here till around 8:30. And we'd love to hear from you on this topic of bullying. The title of the show tonight is called Everybody Knows. And this is an article that you can read at bullyproofclassroom.com. I guess that would be your way of getting the transcript for what we're going to chat about. And I have often said that some of the worst conversations that you have with people are the ones that you think you have. And it is so true. We are poor communicators. We are, when it comes down to dealing with information that is difficult to communicate. We don't like to give people bad news. We certainly don't like to tell people what we really think. We don't enjoy being in a position where we're going to feel confronted when we end up sharing bad news or sharing what we really think about any different topic. And sometimes we just agree because we don't want the confrontation, but we can walk away with a nagging feeling that we have in the center of our stomach because we really didn't voice and say what we wanted to say. And victims of bullying are very much like this. They don't have the capacity to communicate with the bully or with an adult, and oftentimes they will emotionally hide. And they will live their life wishing that they had the nerve, the guts, the courage to say what's really on their mind. And those of you who are therapists and so on know that holding stuff inside can produce a whole lot of anger, and that anger that gets turned inward can really create a lot of depression. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen a lot of suicides over the years. When it comes down to our kids, and when I say our kids, our school children, our own children, whatever the case may be, not having the capacity to communicate and make their requests known. And sometimes it's just as simple as saying to someone who is confronting them or giving them a hard time, just to stop and knock it off. I have witnessed this with adults in faculty rooms with years ago, teachers would be talking about topics that were offensive to other people, and people would just walk out of the faculty room rather than saying, I'm really not happy with what's being said here. And it could be off-color jokes. It could be someone's getting picked on. Maybe someone is the brunt of a joke, whatever the case may be. Adults do this as well. Adults are as involved with this type of behavior as well. And we need to be aware of what we like and what we don't like, and we need to be willing to stand up for what we believe is right as we take these steps in this thing called life. And in terms of how we deal with other people, healthy relationships have a certain amount of confrontation to them because we have to speak our mind. We have to say what we believe, and we can't be muzzled into a position where we don't say what's on our mind. If you go to bullyproofclassroom.com, you're going to find there an article that is called Everybody Knows. And Everybody Knows is basically 10 things that I believe people know, whether they be in education, they're a parent, just an adult, could be a car mechanic, could be anything. And they know them, but they are not spoken about. They are not addressed. They are things that people kind of kick under the rug. They may get spoken about to people who, when they speak to these people about it, they are of no consequence. In other words, they're not going to confront them on it. They just agree with everything that's being said. The two people can have this conversation, and it's no big deal. I'm talking about the adults who are stakeholders in schools, and that means your superintendents, your principals, your vice principals, your teachers, and parents as well, because your children are going to some of these schools that have some of the difficulty that we have right now. And the beginning of the article just talks about, you know, the dysfunction and the deviance and the denial in terms of what we know that we don't talk about. And there are things that go on that are just so obvious, and there's really an 800-pound gorilla in the room, and he's being ignored. And I list 10 things that parents and educators and society, for that matter, know, and for some reason won't discuss them or won't even admit to them. As a parent myself, I like to think that my kids are perfect. In other words, they're never going to do anything wrong. And that's the furthest thing from the truth. It's the furthest thing from the truth. My kids are like any other kid. They're going to lie. They're going to bend the truth. They're going to say things that they don't mean. They're going to have a sense of entitlement at times where they think that they deserve to get something. So kids have these different thoughts that they walk around with. And they have a tendency to act out. By the way, just as an aside, if you have a kid as a parent and you are reactive to that child on a continuous basis, and you do no teaching in terms of the behavior that you want to see from him, but you react to everything that he does wrong, you are doing nothing more than producing a perfect, exquisite, wonderful liar, because he will always poke around, or she will always poke around in the dark to try and figure out exactly what you want to hear. And that's an important piece to know, because our kids become adults, and you don't want him or her to be what I call a yes man. You want them to have certain standards and principles that they live their life by, that they stand up for, and that they have the courage to stand up for as an adult. And you want them to be able to speak their mind, whether it be to their boss, to their spouse, to whatever the case may be. And you want them to have the ability to have conversation that talks about what is truly on their mind. Because as they grow older and they get married and they end up with spouses, what will happen is they will stay bottled up, and they will not share information because they're afraid of a reaction from their spouse. So our kids have to learn how to say things to other people as they get older, and create what's called a productive conflict. And we're going to talk about that in our discussion tonight. But the only thing that a productive conflict is it's the ability for two people to leave enough space in a conversation for a disagreement. and I've spoken about this before, and it comes from Dr. Robin Odegaard, who shared this information with me on one of the shows that I was doing a while ago, and she talked about this, and I found it very interesting, and I think it's something that we all need to be aware of. But everybody knows that disrespect is pervasive in society. Everybody knows this, and nobody wants to talk about it. And our kids grow up to become adults, and who believe that they can say and do whatever they want. Those of you who are in education know what it's like to deal with a confrontational parent who believes that their kid is never wrong, who believes that when they come into a school, they should get whatever they want. We all talk about it. What are we going to do about it? How do you manage this type of problem that we have? We complain about it. And this fear that we have ascends the ranks. And by that I mean it is top down. A superintendent of schools is a position. And oftentimes the person who's in that position will hide behind the position. Follow me on that. You can't hide behind your position. Whether you are a principal, vice principal, supervisor, teacher even, you know, director, it doesn't matter. That's just your position. You are a person and you deserve respect, and you can't use the position to get it. And superintendents and principals have a tendency to hide behind those positions, and they are also in fear of irate parents. No one confronts, everybody runs. And the schools truly are controlled by about 20% of the parents, and I say it in the article, with the biggest mouths and the most threatening attitudes and behavior. As we have 20%, we will always spend 80% of our time dealing with 20% of our kids. On 20% of the kids. And 80% of our time will be spent on 20% of the parents. As a vice principal many years ago, one of the things that I used to do when I got a referral that would be sent down to me, a discipline referral, is I would look at the referral, and I wasn't concerned about the kid's name that was on the referral. I was more worried about who the parent was that I was going to have to deal with. Think about that for a minute. I would almost be rethinking how I was going to discipline that kid based upon who the parent was. I'm sitting here in this chair in my office, and I'm willing to admit that to you. I am willing to admit that I would reconsider discipline based upon who the parent was of the kid that was being disciplined. Have you ever done that as a teacher? Have you ever done that as an administrator? Those are the things that we need to talk about. Why are we so fearful of those parents? Because they have a big mouth? One of the things I'll share, again, is that the only thing we have to overcome in dealing with the irate is the fear of being yelled at. And you have to evaluate where that fear comes from. You have to take a look at where the fear comes from. That fear probably comes from an imprint that you got from your childhood. Going back to this fear of having our own parents yell at us. And some young teachers who have only been in the field for a few years, they can begin to get shoved around so bad because parents come into the school, okay, and they start talking to them like they're a three-year-old, and they can make that teacher feel like a three-year-old. We all know that parents are the ones that are paying the taxes in the town. We all know it as educators. But no one deserves to be abused, certainly not a teacher who is providing a service for the children in the town, and that is to educate them, to build a relationship with them, to teach them some morals, some character, and certainly the three R's of respect and responsibility, and help them learn how to deal with relationships as they grow older. But again, we have parents who have matured physically but not emotionally, and they come in and they give us a hard time. No one talks about this stuff. Everyone is aware of it, but no one has a conversation about it. And no one certainly wants to do a whole lot about it except complain. And I think it's time that we took a step back and said, what can we do? And it's almost as if we have to take back the surrendered ground that we've allowed in our schools and in our culture when it comes down to this idea of respect and responsibility. The next one that we have there is everybody knows that no one has self-control. And I just don't mean, you know, kids in school and so on. I mean, if you're taking a real good look at the condition of society, have you? One in four homes are in foreclosure right now. One in four. You know what that means? That some either your mortgage was too big for you, or maybe we could blame the banks. Or I don't even know if we can blame the banks anymore. Because in the final analysis, it was the buyer that made the decision. We all want something a little bit bigger and a little bit better. But what we forget is in order to get what's bigger and better, we have to have the money to do it. And you can never presume upon the future. And presuming upon the future means I'm going to take this mortgage, even though it's too big, and the banks, going back several years, were doling out mortgages to just about anybody. And I'm going to presume that I'm going to make the money to be able to cover that mortgage down the road. Self-control teaches you have this amount of money, you work within your means. But everybody wants bigger and better. And to get bigger and better, the money has to be made to get it. Let's take a look at things like teenage obesity, diabetes, addiction, alcoholism. These are all evidences of a lack of self-control. Now, I'm not going to get into the debate with anyone who may be listening to this in terms of alcoholism being a disease or a problem with self-control. I'm sure that it's both. But the bottom line is, even if I have diabetes, I know I have a disease, I still have to control what I eat in order to control the diabetes. There is a certain amount of responsibility that we all have. And we have that responsibility not only with our physical health, but with our emotional health. Because there's a tremendous amount of leftover bitterness in us as adults. Either it could be our upbringing, it could be, again, the imprint that we got from our parents on how to cope and manage difficulties. And that could wreak havoc in our own families. We are all responsible for five things: thoughts, words, actions, attitudes, and motives. Thoughts, words, actions, attitudes, and motives. Our thoughts, our words, and our actions are under our control. We can control what we think. We can control what we say. And we can control how we act. There's an old Buddhist saying, and I hope I get it right. Words fitly spoken should be spoken kindly, truthfully, and they should be necessary. And oftentimes we say things that are just unnecessary, just because we want to say them. And sometimes we have to evaluate our motive for saying them. How do you help someone develop greater control or self-control? Well, how do you stop somebody from speeding? How do you stop somebody from speeding? You give them a ticket. The ticket is the consequence for the speeding. And that's the way you help someone develop self-control. Does someone have to have a heart attack before they quit smoking? That's a consequence. Does someone have to incur all manner of health problems before they quit eating? That's a control issue. And I know people eat and drink and do a lot of things for a lot of different reasons. But in the final analysis, we all are responsible for our own level of self-control. And right now we're sitting in a leaking boat. And many of us are experiencing the consequences of a lack of self-control. That was one of my dad's big things. You got to control yourself. You have to have some control. You have to do things that you don't like. He was also big on consistency. And he was also big on adjustment. And over the years when I was playing sports in high school and in college, I learned the benefit of certain behaviors. Consistency was one of them. You do the same things, you develop the same habits, you work to develop principles in your life and standards in your life. Now, if the standards are off base, and if they're wrong, and they're offensive, then you have to make adjustments. We will always determine the adjustments that we have to make in our life as we get older and we enter into a relationship. Because then we're going to have to evaluate whether or not the relationship is worth the adjustment. And we need to be confronted at certain points in that relationship, and we need to be made aware, because we all have blind spots where we think we're doing everything right, and in reality, certain things that we do may not be totally right. And someone else has to tell us. Sometimes it's a good friend. Sometimes it's our own children. Sometimes it's a spouse or a potential spouse. And they make you aware of certain things. Because even though every single thing that you do may appear right to you, may look right to you, it may be just that, just to you, and there may be adjustments that you have to make in certain behaviors, and that also is part of being a person who has self-control. Now, this next thing that everybody knows is something that is controversial. Nobody enjoys talking about it. It's something that maybe we use it far too often. Maybe we use it as an out for kids who are out of control and have behavior problems in school. Maybe we use it as an excuse for behavior that's out of control. Or maybe we use it as an excuse because we just don't flat out know how to discipline kids. But what I'm talking about here is the medicalizing of education. And in my years as an educator, what I found is that medication works. It works when we treat attention deficit disorder. It works when we treat oppositional defiant disorder. It does help kids with these conditions. But if you talk to a therapist, what they will tell you is that medication in combination with therapy is the plan that nets the best results. Are you hearing me? There's a combination plan there. Usually the medication helps open the mind of the person to make them more in tune with the therapist, and they can hear things better. And they also can control themselves better and can deal with the recommendations better. In schools, medication is relied on too heavily, because that's all they want to use in terms of managing the behavior. If we use medication with effective discipline and solid discipline and effective consequences, we will have a better result. See, I used to be somebody that would say, oh no, forget about medication, just deal with the discipline. Well, in reality, that may not work. Some kids do have organic problems that have to be dealt with medically, and I understand that. But I also believe that if we don't have an effective discipline plan in place, what will happen is that we will rely on the medication to do the job. I used to have parents that I spoke to whose kids were absolutely driving me crazy, and I'd say to them, you know, your son is driving me crazy here today, and their excuse would be he didn't take his pill. And yeah, you know, my response wanted to be, I didn't take mine either. Medication can't be the only way out. And you know, I just have a very basic question: Where was ADD and ODD 40 years ago? Where? I mean, I never heard of them. Either they didn't exist or they weren't invented yet, I guess. And the way I look at it is because the behavior of the kids, when kids acted up 40 years ago, they had other options for kids then. You could go to vocational school. You could join the service. You could go to an alternative school. You could go to an adult school. Or, you know, you could be asked to sign out and you'd get a general education diploma if your behavior was wreaking havoc on the school. Authority was respected by parents and by students. often what happens when we discover that disrespect is the norm and not the exception, which has happened in our schools. See, I like to use the example. What do you do if one person burns the American flag? Well, you throw them in jail. That was the rule many years ago. What do you do if 5,000 people burn the flag and the jails aren't big enough to hold them? You create a law that says freedom of speech, you can burn the flag. Same thing here. What happens when we discover that disrespect is the norm and not the exception? Sometimes we can create a condition to support the behavior. In other words, we give him a condition or her a condition because we can't control the behavior. We can't even manage the parent. So we end up with conditions to support the behavior. And then we medicalize or we put the kid on medication to help control it. Now he has a condition. Now it's a medical condition. And that's the reason why he acts the way that he does. Sometimes if kids act up today, it's attributed to the fact that he doesn't take medication consistently, when in reality, he's not being disciplined effectively. And sometimes when you look at effective discipline, if it's done right, it can control behavior. And that's something that we have to become more aware of. Everybody knows that disrespect is pervasive in society. Everybody knows that no one has self-control. And everybody knows that we've medicalized education. Three things that we know that don't get discussed. And, you know, our schools are starting to come down around us. And we have to become more aware of what's happening as a society and as a culture. Ann Hendershock wrote a book, and she is she's a social worker. She was a professor at the University of San Diego, and she now works at King's College in New York. The title of the book was The Politics of Deviance. And in that book, she stated that oftentimes parents who are having difficulty with their children are relieved to find out that it's a condition and it's not them. I remember watching House, one of my favorite TV shows maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And there was a child that was being treated by House. And his behavior was rude, disrespectful, discourteous, out of control. No one on the diagnostic team liked the kid. They didn't know what to do with him, and they found a T-shaped tumor in a part of his brain that controls behavior and impulse control. And when the mother found out that this tumor was located where it was, she was so relieved that this tumor was causing this horrible behavior that she was like, "You mean it's not me?" She was happy that her kid had a condition as opposed to her not knowing how to discipline. They figure if you take the tumor out, everything's going to be fine. Well, they took the tumor out and everything wasn't fine, and the kid ended up with another condition that they discovered further on down the road in the show. And House went in to talk to the mother, and his comment to her was, he has this condition. It wasn't the tumor that caused, you know, the behavior. And he said, and oh, by the way, it is you who has produced this type of behavior in this kid. It's a pretty strong statement. And sometimes parents have to own that stuff. When they look at their own children and they discover that their behavior is out of control, they can't blame the system, they can't blame society, they can't blame the culture, they can't blame teachers. But over a period of time, they ended up not imposing effective consequences. And the behavior, starting probably around the age of 2 or 3 or 4, kids started to draw conclusions that they can get away with things. And as they got bigger and bigger, and by that I mean the kids got older and older, the behavior became out of control and they really didn't know what to do. So then it must be someone else's fault, or it must be an organic problem. The responsibility lied with the parent, but they didn't want to admit it. Another thing that everybody knows is kids who have behavioral difficulties are not likable. Hear me on that. Kids who have behavioral difficulties are not likable. Now, we've been trained as educators and as professionals to make the statement, I like you, but I don't like your behavior. That's a lie. That's an outright lie. And if we would just be honest with ourselves for just a moment, we would begin to admit that we don't like the kid. And realistically, we're all measured by our own behavior. I own my behavior. I am my behavior. Like being but not my behavior? I don't think so. And I've talked to teachers about this, and I said, if there was a person that you had a problem with and came into the faculty room and you didn't like them, would you be able to make that statement? There are adults that we don't like because of their behavior. We don't want to be in their presence. We might be married to one, for all I know about certain people. Kids are no different. The truth is, I really don't like you. And teachers have got to come clean with that real quick, because kids pick up on whether or not you like them or you don't. I used to have a youngster who was in one of my classes going back more than 30 years, who was an absolute pain in the neck. The rest of the class didn't like him. And I used to go home at night just praying that he would take one day off. And one day he did take off. And he wasn't there in the morning. And I felt like I was going to have a great day. And he showed up later on in the day, somewhere around 11 o'clock, and these kids always would come in right before lunchtime. And when I saw him, my shoulders slumped, my countenance changed, my expression changed, and he knew right then and there that I didn't like him. He knew it right then and there. Yet, I am trained at that point to say, I like you, but I don't like your behavior. How could I convince a kid of that when I have that type of look on my face when I see him? I certainly wasn't smiling, that's for sure. And we need to come clean with that. And if we're having difficulty with a kid, we've got to do what's necessary to build a relationship with the kids that we like the least. Because that is what we're paid to do. the ones that it's easy to have a relationship with a kid that we like, but we're not going to like every kid. And it's those kids that give us the most trouble, that if we work on building a powerful relationship with them, their behavior will change. And I often tell teachers to practice something called the 2x10. 2 minutes a day, 10 days straight, have a conversation with a kid who you have the most trouble with, like you would with your best friend or a good friend. And it's only a matter of, hey, how you doing? What's going on today? Good to see you. And that's it. And, you know, you do that for 7 or 8 days. Around the 8th day, that kid is going to start looking to you for the conversation. And that's what you want. But don't go around thinking that I like the kid but don't like his behavior. In reality, you don't like the kid. And you do hope that he takes the next day off. The next thing that everybody knows that nobody talks about years ago, the only thing we ever wanted from a kid was for him to obey. Just do what I'm telling you to do. Now it's the last thing that we get. And those that sit in the ivory tower of theory and who are professors at colleges liken this word obedience to dog training, and in fact, to them, it's a dirty word. They want to attack education from a theoretical standpoint, but in reality, they may never have spent any time interacting in a classroom with a group of wild kids. See, they fear that they're going to destroy the creative side of a kid's brain by not allowing him to choose and by forcing obedience. When I used to do in-services and I would talk to teachers, the word obedient was a word that they liked the least. So I had to change it to compliance. And the definition of compliance is doing what you're told when you're told to do it with a good attitude. That's it. Wouldn't it be nice if you said to a kid in a classroom, sit down, and he sat down? We think that there's a choice that they have. And kids should be given choice, but they need to be obedient first. Then the choice comes. And sometimes we can develop obedience in a child by using choice to our advantage. Because we have to have a goal of what we want the kid to do. It can't be either get in your seat or get out. The end result has to be what we wanted, and that means the kid sat down. Now, we can't say to a kid, you can either get in your seat or I'm going to put you in your seat, because that would just get us in trouble. But with parents and young children, I want to tell you that the most important thing that you could ever remember is what your goal is at certain points. You want kids to eat dinner at the table, and you relax the rule because it's too much of an effort to enforce the rule, that kid will begin to catch on real quick that you're giving in, because you didn't have a goal of what you really wanted him to do. You wanted him to sit at the table. How are you going to get him to sit at the table? Well, it doesn't start when they're 7 or 8. It starts when they're like 1 or 2, when they can get the idea that you want them to obey you. And you're going to make sure that they do obey, because your goal is to make sure that they're doing what they're told, when they're told to do it, with the right attitude. The next thing that we do, that everybody knows, is we lie to kids. You heard that right. We lie to kids. We lie to kids for the same reason that kids lie to us, because now they're older and we don't want that, the reaction. There are kids that are just not that smart. And I hate to break the news to the world tonight, but everybody's not going to college. Everybody is not going to college. The biggest mistake we made in education happened about 20 years ago when we started to eliminate vocational schools, or created vocational schools that were just for the higher functioning kids. And we created post-secondary programs where kids had to pay tuition in order to go, either to go to post-secondary school for beauty culture, auto mechanics, heating and air conditioning. My heating and air conditioning man right now is a student that I had when he was 14 years old, which is around 35 years ago. No, 30 years ago, about 30 years ago. He's 44 now. He was a student that I had. He was a special ed student. I went into a child study team meeting for an annual review. His father was sitting there. I had a conversation with his dad, and I said to the dad, "What do you do for a living?" He says, "I do heating and air conditioning." The child study team walked in and said, "We have Brian's IEP here," and I went over it and I said, "His dad is doing heating and air conditioning. Can't we send him to vocational school for heating and air conditioning?" The father agreed to it. The child study team liked the idea. The kid went through 2 years of vocational training, came out. He has his own business right now, and he's a millionaire. He has a $1 million business. I don't know if he's a millionaire. And he's good at what he does, because he had one of the best apprenticeship programs you could ever imagine. It was his father's business. Everybody isn't going to college, and everyone can't afford post-secondary training. The unemployment rate is what it is today because people who could be trained to do certain things can't afford the money to go to post-secondary, and it's the training they should have gotten when they were in high school. So what do? We lie to kids and we inflate their grades, because we don't want to destroy their self-esteem. And I don't even know what self-esteem is. To be honest with you, I think kids feel good about themselves today for no apparent reason. And I'm going to, you know, I mean, are we going to get into the no kid gets left back? We know. No child left behind. Some kids need to be left behind. I get tired of teachers taking the blame for poor test scores and for kids not doing well. We get the blame for everything today. I was watching Neil Cavuto on Fox Television 3 years ago interviewing Jack LaLanne. And Neil Cavuto's statement to Jack LaLanne was, "What are we going to do about the problem of childhood obesity and diabetes?" And Jack's comment was, "The first thing we have to do is get all that junk out of the schools." Excuse me, Jack. It's not my fault that these kids are overweight. I agree, schools should provide healthy lunches, there's no doubt about it. But the bottom line is what the child is being fed at home and what type of eating habits he's developing at home. Not whether or not the school is causing it, But what's happening at home? We are not to blame for a kid's low test scores. Some kids are just not designed to go to college, but they have to have training in some type of vocational skill. And it can't be post-secondary because everyone can't afford post-secondary. So we let the kid know that he's doing great academically. And we give him a false sense of his academic ability. Truthfully, what will happen is someone is going to tell him one day that he is not that smart. Like the college he's going to try and get into in a few years. Then for sure, everybody's going to know, including him. I mean, these are common sense items that are on the table in our society and in our culture. And we all are aware of them. They've been discussed many times, many, many times, but we're not taking enough action. I have a few more of these, and I'm going to have to do another show because I really want to continue this discussion, and I don't want to rush through the last four that I have. Dude, I think it's just that important. And I hope if you download this show or archive this show, because I have no listeners, and that's understandable because I haven't done a show in a long time, that you email me because I want to hear from you. And you can email me at proactive7@verizon.net. And we can have a conversation about some of these things that everybody knows. Go to the website, www.bullyproofclassroom.com. Take a look at what's there. Get yourself involved in that graduate course. Go to www.therTC.net. Take the Bullyproof Classroom. Get yourself ready for the online professional development that's going to be coming. We have a job to do. I'm 58 years old right now. I want to work at this for another few years and see where I'm at. But I do believe that it takes a team to do it, and I want to pass this mantle to somebody else. Maybe it'll be my kids. I don't know. But there are so many things that have gone on societally related to education and related to what is just absolutely the truth that people just don't want to address. Real quick, some things that everybody knows: disrespect is pervasive in society. No one has self-control. We've medicalized education. I like you but don't like your behavior is an absolute lie. We absolutely have to get compliance from a kid first. And we've inflated kids' grades, no question about it. Listen, folks, I'm serious about this stuff. Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's make a change. Let's be the change that we want to see in society and in our culture. Schools don't change on their own. It was delightful speaking to you folks again tonight. I hope those of you who archive it, okay, really take it seriously. Have a great night. And I'll talk to you again next week. I'm going to try and do it same time and probably the same day. So we'll see you again next week.